There is this very specific, deeply universal kind of terror that comes with standing at the front of a room,
Oh, absolutely.
like looking out at a group of people and knowing with absolute certainty that you are being judged on every single syllable that comes out of your mouth.
Right. It's a completely visceral reaction.
It really is. I mean, your heart rate spikes, your mouth goes completely dry, your palms start sweating, and suddenly you completely forget what you were going to say.
You forget your own name sometimes.
Exactly. You forget where you normally put your hands. Honestly, you just forget how to be a normal functioning human being. And we have all experienced this, right? Like whether it's, giving a high stakes presentation at a corporate job or pitching a new client or even just standing up to give a toast at a best friend's wedding, it is terrifying.
Well, the physical reaction you're describing there, it's the classic hardwired physiological response to a perceived threat.
Right, the fight or flight thing.
Exactly. In that exact moment, your brain isn't processing higher order abstract concepts. It isn't accessing your creative problem-solving skills or your nuanced vocabulary.
It's just panicking.
Yeah, your amygdala has essentially hijacked the system. Your cognitive resources are entirely consumed by the perceived social threat of that audience sitting in front of you.
Yeah.
You're in pure survival mode.
Pure survival mode. And I mean, we've all been there. But imagine for a second if that feeling of intense, relentless scrutiny wasn't just a one-off event.
Oh boy.
Right? Imagine if that white-knuckle panic was the primary structural way you were expected to learn how to do your job.
That sounds exhausting.
It does. But that is the actual reality for countless professionals in training. And today, we are bringing you into a fascinating deep dive on exactly that scenario.
Yes, we are.
We are examining an incredible, just truly out-of-the-box solution that completely flips the script on how adults learn complex skills under immense pressure.
And the foundation of our deep dive today is this highly compelling, really robustly designed, quasi-experimental study.
Right.
It's titled Gamified Micro-Teaching for ELT Teacher Training.
Yeah.
Now, ELT, for those who might not know, stands for English Language Teaching.
Okay.
And what the researchers in this study have done is take a long, incredibly hard look at the traditional and historically anxiety-inducing gauntlet of teacher training.
Which is brutal.
It is. And they asked a radical, deeply disruptive question. They asked, what actually happens to the adult brain if we take this high-stakes, stressful evaluation and systematically turn it into a game?
And so the mission of this deep dive is to explore the specific granular mechanics of that transformation. We are going to look at how introducing deliberate game design elements, so things like, specific missions, digital badges, and anonymized points, how that doesn't just make a college course more fun, but actually fundamentally rewires an adult learner's ability to take risks.
Right, and absorb feedback.
Yes, and engage deeply with complex material.
Because it is crucial to understand from the very outset here that this is not about trivializing
No,
education.
not at all.
It isn't about slapping some gold stars on a syllabus just to, pander to students. It is about deeply understanding and leveraging human psychology.
Which is the coolest part?
It really is. So, through this deep dive, we're going to dissect the empirical data, the significant statistical effect sizes, and the very real lived experiences of these adult trainees. We need to understand why gamification works on a neurological, emotional, and pedagogical level.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because learning to teach in a traditional evaluative setting is like, oh, it's like trying to learn to ride a bicycle for the very first time.
Okay, I like this analogy.
Right. But instead of an empty, quiet parking lot where you can wobble and fall in peace, you are placed on a brightly lit stage.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And sitting right there in the front row is a panel of stern Olympic judges holding up scorecards, and they are judging every single wobble, every overcorrection, every single time you put your foot down to catch your balance.
That sounds like an actual nightmare.
It is. And under those conditions, it absolutely guarantees you will never try a new trick. You are never going to experiment with your balance.
Because the risk is too high.
Exactly. You are just going to grip the handlebars until your knuckles turn white and pray you survive the ride without totally humiliating yourself.
What's fascinating here is that the researchers driving this study recognized that exact paralyzing dynamic. They point out a massive blind spot in traditional pedagogy.
Which is.
They argue that we cannot just look at what these teacher trainees are theoretically learning from their textbooks. We have to look deeply at why their internal emotional state dictates their ultimate success or failure in actually applying that knowledge.
Ah, okay.
The affective state, so the internal emotional weather of the learner, the anxiety, the fear, the confidence, that is the critical, often completely ignored variable that traditional training paradigms simply fail to account for.
So to really appreciate the brilliance of the gamified solution they eventually built, we first need to thoroughly understand the broken mechanism it is trying to fix.
Yes, we do.
We need to talk about the concept of micro-teaching. Now, if you aren't in the education field, you know, listening to this, you might not know this term, but it is the absolute cornerstone of how teachers, especially language teachers, are trained at universities worldwide.
It's practically a rite of passage.
It really is. So let's paint a picture of what a typical micro-teaching session actually looks like in practice.
Sure. So micro-teaching is a universally applied technique used in pre-service teacher education. The core concept is actually quite straightforward and, honestly, initially very well-intentioned.
Right, the idea was good.
Yeah. A teacher candidate who has been studying educational theory for years prepares a short, highly focused, condensed lesson. This is usually just like 10 to 20 minutes long.
That's a little bite-sized lesson.
Exactly. Wow. They are then required to deliver this micro-lesson to a small group of students. But the catch, however, is that these students are very often just their own peers.
Wait, their classmates?
Yes. It's their fellow university classmates play-acting as English language learners who supposedly don't understand the language.
Right. So you have a 22-year-old college senior standing in front like five of their friends who also speak perfect English.
Yeah.
And the teacher trainee has to pretend to teach them basic vocabulary. It's a 15-minute, highly artificial mock lesson.
The artificiality is intense.
Mm-hmm.
But the original historical intent behind micro-teaching, which, by the way, was developed back in the 1960s at Stanford University, it was actually very noble.
Okay, what was the original goal?
It was designed to create a supportive, predictable, and highly controlled laboratory environment. The idea was to isolate a very specific granular teaching skill.
Like what?
Maybe it's how to give clear instructions without using complex jargon, or how to visually map out a grammar concept on a whiteboard.
Okay, that makes sense.
The theory was that trainees could practice these isolated skills in a safe sandbox before they were thrown to the wolves in a real, unpredictable classroom full of 30 actual teenagers.
I mean, logically, on paper, that makes perfect sense. You practice the small fundamental parts in isolation before you are asked to play the whole game.
Right.
Like an athlete practices free throws before playing a championship match. A musician practices scales before playing a concerto.
Exactly.
But the literature review in our source material is incredibly damning regarding how this traditional micro-teaching format actually plays out in modern universities today. It is a spectacular, almost tragic departure from that noble, supportive intent.
The literature paints a very grim picture. Instead of feeling like a supportive, low-stakes laboratory for experimentation, trainees almost universally describe these micro-teaching sessions as artificial, rigidly segmented, unchanging, and overwhelmingly anxiety-inducing.
Overwhelmingly.
Yeah. The environment is sterile, and the feedback loop is often perceived as punitive rather than constructive.
I can completely see why. I mean, let's go back to that room. You were standing there trying to teach the past tense to your friends who are awkwardly pretending to be confused.
Which is awkward enough.
Right. But the real issue isn't the friends. The real issue is the professor sitting at the back of the room with a clipboard, taking notes on every single thing you do wrong.
The presence of the evaluator completely changes the psychological dynamic of the room. The deeper issue is fundamentally about how the trainees themselves perceive the exercise.
How do they perceive it?
Well, even though the university syllabus might label this as a formative learning opportunity, meaning it's supposed to be a safe place to make mistakes, receive guidance, and incrementally grow.
Right, formative.
The trainees overwhelmingly experience it as a summative assessment. They view it as a final, high-stakes judgment of their inherent worth, their intelligence, and their ultimate potential to ever be a successful teacher.
Wow. So they aren't thinking, hey, this is a great chance to practice my whiteboard skills.
Not at all.
They are thinking, if I stutter, my professor's going to think I'm an idiot, my peers are going to judge me, and my entire career is doomed.
Yes. They are in pure survival mode. And the study emphasizes that this anxiety is particularly disastrous for the specific field of English language teaching, or ELT.
Let's drill down into that. Why is training to be a language teacher so uniquely vulnerable to this kind of performance anxiety?
Well, to understand that vulnerability, you really have to understand the evolution of language pedagogy.
Okay.
Decades ago, language teaching was mostly about rote memorization. The teacher stood at the front, lectured about grammar rules, and the students quietly copied verb conjugation tables into their notebooks.
Very traditional.
Very. And if you were training for that, a rigid, scripted, micro-teaching session might actually be fine. But modern English language classrooms are entirely different. They need to be highly dynamic, deeply communicative, and fiercely interactive.
Because you're trying to get people to actually speak to each other.
Exactly. A modern ELT teacher doesn't just deliver information, they facilitate spontaneous human interaction.
Which is incredibly unpredictable.
Immensely unpredictable. A modern language teacher has to constantly read the room. They have to adjust their speaking pace on the fly based on, you know, the blank stares they might be getting.
Yeah, right.
They have to actively encourage hesitant students to speak up. And crucially, they have to react in real time to the weird, unexpected, grammatically incorrect things language learners will inevitably say.
Because they're learning.
Right. Orchestrating that kind of dynamic interaction requires a tremendous amount of cognitive flexibility, adaptability, and above all, a willingness to take risks.
But, and here's the catch, if your brain is utterly consumed by survival mode because of that professor glaring at you from the back of the room with a clipboard, you are absolutely not going to take any risks.
Any risks.
You are going to play it as safe as humanly possible.
And this is where we run straight into a massive psychological block. It's a concept known in linguistics and education as the affective filter.
The affective filter.
Yes. It was originally hypothesized by linguist Stephen Krashen. When a learner's anxiety is high, or their self-esteem is low, or they're feeling defensive, this affective filter goes up.
Okay, what does that actually mean in the brain?
You can think of it as a literal neurological brick wall slamming down in the brain.
Right.
It actively blocks the processing of new, complex information, and it severely limits the capacity of your working memory.
So let's walk through the exact mechanics of a failed micro-teaching session. Our trainee stands up there to do their 15-minute mock lesson. The clipboard comes out. The affective filter slams down. What actually happens to their lesson plan? What do they physically do?
The trainees immediately default to safety.
Well,
because their working memory is hijacked by anxiety, they cannot handle the cognitive load of a dynamic, unscripted interaction.
So what's the backup plan?
They write heavily scripted, rigid, hyper-controlled lesson plans. They will stand up and literally read from their notes.
Oh, painful.
Very. They deliberately avoid trying to facilitate open-ended conversations because, well, an unscripted conversation might go off the rails. A peer might ask a question they don't know the answer to, and then they might look foolish in front of the evaluator.
Right, it's self-preservation.
Exactly.
Huh.
They fail to develop what the pedagogical literature calls pedagogical content knowledge, or PCK. They fail to develop this because their mental bandwidth is entirely consumed by managing their own physiological stress.
Wow.
They aren't responding to the needs of the students in front of them. They're just desperately trying to survive the next 15 minutes without completely falling apart.
Now, I have to play devil's advocate here for a second, because I know there are people listening to this who are thinking, wait a minute, isn't pressure a vital part of professional training?
It's a fair question.
Right. Real teaching is incredibly stressful. A real classroom is chaotic, it's noisy, it's demanding. Doesn't a trial by fire during university training forge better, stronger, more resilient teachers? I mean, if a 22-year-old can't handle 15 minutes of mild scrutiny in front of their friends, how on earth are they going to handle a room full of 30 hormonal, apathetic teenagers on a Friday afternoon?
It is a very common argument.
Yeah.
And it appeals to a sort of traditional, hard-nosed view of professional development. But it completely misunderstands the neurological mechanics of how complex cognitive skills are actually acquired.
How so?
Well, a trial by fire might test your emotional endurance, and it might weed out people who simply can't handle stress. But it does not, and cannot, teach you a new, complex, adaptive skill.
Okay, give me an example.
Imagine trying to learn how to play a highly complicated, unfamiliar piece of music on the piano for the very first time. And while you're trying to find middle C, a drill sergeant is standing inches from your face, screaming at you to play faster. Right. You might learn to slam a few keys out of pure terror, but you will absolutely not learn the nuance, the timing, the delicate fingering, or the musicality of the piece.
You wouldn't learn to play the piano. You'd just learn how to panic really, really effectively.
Exactly. You would train your brain to associate the piano with trauma. Pressure specifically kills communicative language teaching because genuine communication inherently involves profound vulnerability.
You have to make mistakes to speak a new language.
You have to be willing to make mistakes. If you are terrified of making a mistake in front of your professor, you will deliberately choose not to ask an open-ended question to your class because you won't know how to handle their unpredictable, messy answer.
That makes total sense.
The researchers behind this study realized a fundamental truth. If they actually wanted these pre-service teachers to learn how to beautifully orchestrate dynamic, messy human interaction, they had to completely dismantle the threat architecture of the traditional micro-teaching environment.
They had to tear down the wall.
They had to find a way to permanently lower the effective filter.
And the hypothesized antidote to this deeply ingrained poison of academic pressure is gamification. Now, we hear that buzzword constantly, right? It's in corporate marketing, it's in fitness apps, it's in loyalty programs.
It's everywhere.
But how does turning a serious, rigorous university class into a game actually fix deep-seated, neurologically hardwired performance anxiety?
That is the core question.
To answer that, we really need to transition into the profound theoretical frameworks that the researchers used to build this intervention. Because, as the study makes incredibly clear, successful gamification is not just about slapping some digital points and shiny badges onto a boring silver.
Far from it. If you just add points to a broken system, you just have a broken system with points.
Right.
The study defines gamification very strictly. It is the deliberate introduction of game-like design features, such as specific missions, structured points, visual badges, and dynamic leaderboards into non-gaming real-world contexts.
Oh.
But the transformative power of gamification doesn't lie in the digital pixels of a badge or the, you know, aesthetic of a leaderboard. The power lies entirely in how those specific game mechanics seamlessly map onto and fulfill established theories of human motivation and learning.
The primary foundational psychological theory they lean on heavily in the study is self-determination theory, or SDT. For anyone listening who is interested in psychology, management, or human behavior, SDT is a massive landscape-altering concept.
It really is. It is the bedrock of modern motivational psychology developed by Richard Ryan and Edward Dexy.
Okay, what does it say?
SDT posits a very clear mechanism. It says that intrinsic motivation, which is that internal self-sustaining drive to do something because it is inherently interesting, challenging, or rewarding.
Doing it because you want to, basically.
Exactly. That intrinsic motivation peaks only when three basic universal psychological needs are consistently met within an environment.
Three needs. Got it.
If an environment starves a person of these three needs, motivation collapses into anxiety or apathy. Those three critical needs are autonomy, competence, and relatedness.
Okay, let's break those three down because they are so crucial to understanding why games are so addicting and why traditional classrooms are so often soul-crushing.
Right.
First is autonomy. This basically means feeling like you have meaningful choices, right? It's the feeling that you are the author of your own actions, not just a pawn following orders.
That is the absolute essence of it. It's the need for self-direction. Think about traditional rote education. Autonomy is often absolute zero.
Just do what you're told.
Right. The curriculum dictates what you must learn. The professor dictates exactly how you must present it. And the schedule dictates precisely when you must do it. You are simply executing a predetermined script.
You are a passenger, not the driver. Okay, so the second core need in SDT is competence. This is the feeling of mastery. It's the deep-seated belief that you are capable of interacting effectively with your environment, of overcoming escalating challenges, and of measurably growing your skills.
Exactly.
But traditional grading systems, especially in things like micro-teaching, often completely destroy a learner's sense of competence. Mm-hmm. A traditional rubric is often just a laundry list highlighting everything you did wrong, every standard you failed to meet.
Traditional evaluation is heavily deficit-focused. It tells you how far you are from perfection rather than how much you have grown from your baseline. It shatters competence.
And then we have the third psychological need, relatedness.
Yes, relatedness. This is the deeply human need to feel connected to others, to feel a sense of belonging, mutual respect, and shared purpose within a community.
And again, look at the traditional micro-teaching environment. It is structurally designed to isolate the learner. In a highly competitive, graded university cohort, your peers are suddenly your competitors for the professor's approval. Or, at best, they are an intimidating, silent audience judging your performance. They are definitively not your collaborative team.
If we connect this to the bigger picture of the study, the absolute brilliance of this intervention is how meticulously the researchers mapped specific game mechanics directly onto those three SDT pillars.
And they matched them up perfectly.
They did. They didn't just brainstorm what might be vaguely fun. They used game design as an architectural tool to engineer deep psychological safety.
And alongside self-determination theory, they also wove in experiential learning theory, specifically David Kolb's famous model.
Ah, yes, Kolb's model.
This is another giant concept in adult education. Kolb argues that real learning isn't just sitting passively and absorbing a lecture. It is an active, continuous four-stage cycle.
Let's walk through the stages.
First, you have a concrete experience. You actually do the thing. Second, you step back for reflective observation. You think about what just happened.
Right.
Third, you engage in abstract conceptualization. You connect your reflections to broader theories or rules. And finally, active experimentation. You take those new theories and try the action again with a modified strategy.
The problem is that traditional micro-teaching almost universally breaks Kolb's cycle.
How so?
Well, you certainly have the concrete experience, that terrifying 15-minute lesson on stage. But the crucial second step, reflective observation, is usually replaced by the professor simply critiquing you.
You aren't reflecting, you're just getting yelled at.
You just receive judgment, which immediately makes you defensive and blocks learning. The abstract conceptualization is often disconnected from the performance. And most damagingly, there is rarely an immediate opportunity for active experimentation.
You don't get to try again.
You do your lesson, you get your bad grade, and the class moves on to the next topic. You don't get to instantly try again with the new feedback. The cycle is shattered.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me. The absolute best analogy that perfectly captures how gamification fixes this broken cycle and satisfies those SDT needs is looking at fitness apps. Or even better, modern video games.
Video games are the perfect example.
Right. Think about playing an incredibly challenging, punishing video game. Something notoriously difficult, like Elden Ring or a classic Mario platformer. You are trying to beat a level, you run into a massive boss battle, and your character gets completely and utterly annihilated. Yeah. You fail spectacularly.
Game over.
Game over. Now, when that happens in a video game, do you feel a deep, crushing sense of personal shame? Do you sit on your couch and feel like you are a fundamental failure as a human being? Do you question your worth?
Generally speaking, no. You might feel a momentary flash of intense frustration. You might, yell at the screen. But that frustration is almost immediately followed by a powerful, intrinsic desire to pick up the controller and try again.
Exactly. Because in a well-designed video game, dying isn't a failure of your identity. It is simply data.
Data. I like that.
It is high-quality, actionable feedback. You watch your character die, and your brain instantly goes into Kolb's learning cycle.
How does that look in the game?
You reflect. Okay, the dragon breathes fire on the third frame of its animation. You conceptualize. So my strategy of rushing in won't work. You actively experiment. Next time, I need to roll left and wait for the opening. And you immediately hit the respawn button.
That's Kolb's cycle right there.
Exactly. The gamification acts as a massive scaffolding that makes the grueling, repetitive cycle of rehearsal, failure, and feedback not just sustainable, but incredibly obsessively enjoyable. It literally shifts the neurology of the brain out of the amygdala's threat state and into the prefrontal cortex's play state.
That shift from threat to play is the absolute crux of this psychological intervention. By deliberately reframing a stressful pedagogical evaluation as an engaging, structured challenge within a clear rule system, you short-circuit the brain's hardwired threat perception.
It's just a game.
It's just a game. You satisfy the need for competence by showing visual incremental progress, even in the midst of failure. You satisfy autonomy by allowing them to choose how they tackle the challenge.
So, having established this incredibly robust, multi-layered psychological theory, the discussion naturally shifts to how this works in reality.
Yes.
How did the researchers practically take these lofty theories of Kolb and SDT and build a gamified world for their university subjects? Let's dive deep into the actual methodology of the experiment.
The researchers were meticulous. They set up a quasi-experimental pre-test, post-test control group design.
Okay.
They recruited 40 pre-service English language teachers from a university training program. It's really important to understand the demographic here.
Yeah.
These were all adults, primarily in their early 20s.
Right.
They completed all their core theoretical coursework. They knew the theories of linguistics and pedagogy, but they had less than 50 hours of actual practical classroom teaching experience.
So they are classic novices. They have all the book smarts in the world. They can write an essay on language acquisition, but they lack the practical on-the-ground flight hours.
Exactly. To ensure strict baseline equivalence and make sure the data would be valid, they randomly assigned these 40 volunteers into two distinct groups of 20.
Okay, 20 and 20.
There was an experimental group that would receive the deeply gamified micro-teaching intervention and a control group that would receive the standard traditional micro-teaching curriculum.
Let's paint a very clear picture of the control group first, because it is vital to remember that what we are about to describe is the exact methodology currently being used in thousands of university classrooms around the world right now to train the next generation of educators.
Right, this is the status quo. For the control group, the process was completely standard. Over a condensed four-week period, these trainees had to prepare and deliver a 15-minute micro lesson once a week. After they stood up and taught their lesson to their peers, they would remain standing at the front of the room and receive verbal public feedback from the course instructor.
Ouch.
Yeah. Their peers, sitting in the audience, would fill out standard written checklist rubrics giving them comments, and then the session would conclude with a general group discussion about the performance.
It sounds so incredibly mundane and routine when you describe it like that. But based on everything we just discussed about the effective filter and SDT, that scenario is pure psychological torture.
It really is.
That is 15 minutes of sweating through your shirt, losing your place in your notes, and hyperventilating, followed immediately by standing frozen in front of the room while a primary authority figure publicly points out all the times you stuttered, all the times you lost control of the lesson pacing, and how your whiteboard handwriting was illegible.
It is an intensely evaluative, high-pressure environment where the focus is overwhelmingly on what went wrong.
Right.
Now, contrast that bleak reality with the environment designed for the experimental group.
Let's hear it.
The researchers didn't change the core requirements. The experimental group still had to teach for 15 minutes, four times a week, but they completely revolutionized the delivery mechanism.
How did they do that?
They built a custom learning management system, or LMS, using the widely available platform called Moodle. And critically, they integrated a specific, robust gamification plugin called Level Up.
Okay, so they took the exact same curriculum requirement for teaching sessions, but they completely, fundamentally changed the psychological framing of the task.
Precisely. In the gamified system, the word session was entirely eliminated.
Oh, interesting.
Instead of telling a trainee you have micro-teaching session 2 on Wednesday, the task was framed and delivered as a mission. Furthermore, the prompt wasn't just a vague directive like teach a grammar point.
What was it?
The prompt was structured as an achievable quest. For example, it would say, Mission 2, successfully implement at least 2 different interactive pair work activities within your lesson.
Wow. That seemingly small shift in language is monumental. It immediately changes the trainee's internal objective. You aren't just stepping on stage trying to survive the judgment of your professor. You have a specific, concrete, achievable quest to complete.
It focuses the mind on a goal rather than on the fear.
Exactly. And how did they re-engineer the dreaded feedback process?
They completely replaced the public critique with a structured system of digital badges and experience points.
Oh, cool.
As the trainees taught their missions, if they clearly demonstrated a specific target competency from the rubric, they earned a highly visual, specialized badge.
Like what kind of badge?
For instance, if a trainee gave incredibly clear, concise instructions for an activity, they might earn the Clarity Captain badge.
Nice.
If they managed to get their hesitant peers talking to each other effectively, they might unlock the Interaction Innovator badge.
Interaction Innovator, I love that.
And these badges were awarded automatically based on the instructor's rubric scores, but they could also be nominated by their peers.
I absolutely love the peer nomination aspect. It changes the audience from passive judges to active talent scouts.
Yes.
They are looking for the good in your lesson, not just the bad. And beyond the badges, there was also an underlying points system, correct? A leaderboard.
Yes. The system maintained a live, dynamic points leaderboard that displayed cumulative experience points. These points were aggregated from both the instructor's formal rubric ratings and the peer ratings.
Okay.
Additionally, they built a dedicated digital feedback forum. In this forum, structured peer comments were posted. And this is a stroke of genius. Trainees actually earned experience points for providing high-quality, deeply analytical feedback to their classmates.
Wait, really?
Yeah. You didn't just get points for teaching well. You got points for helping others teach well.
Okay, wait, hold on. Let me throw a wrench in this.
Go ahead.
Let me point out a glaring potential contradiction here. Didn't we just spend the entire first half of this deep dive heavily establishing that anxiety, intense evaluation, and peer competition were the absolute core poisons destroying traditional micro teaching?
We did.
Doesn't introducing a live leaderboard, a literal numerical ranking of who is the best teacher and who is the worst teacher, doesn't that create a hyper-competitive, deeply toxic, and profoundly stressful environment? To me, putting adult learners on a scoreboard sounds like a recipe for a massive panic attack.
It is a vital, essential question, and you have hit on the most common, disastrous pitfall of poorly designed gamification.
Oh, okay.
The researchers were acutely aware of this risk. Gamification can absolutely backfire and backfire spectacularly if it devolves into a toxic zero-sum competition. However, they meticulously mitigated this threat through highly intentional, psychologically informed game design choices.
How did they fix the leaderboard issue?
First and foremost, the leaderboard displayed anonymized avatars and IDs, not actual student names.
Oh.
You could log in and see where your avatar stood relative to the group average, which provides a healthy sense of the standard and sparks a bit of self-competition.
Hmm.
But you were never publicly shamed or exposed if you were sitting at the very bottom of the board.
Ah, okay. The anonymity is the crucial shield there. It protects the ego while still providing context.
Exactly. The second crucial design choice was that the point system was entirely cumulative and additive.
What does that mean?
In traditional grading, you start with 100% and every mistake bleeds points away until you are left with a C-. It's punitive.
Right.
In this gamified system, you started at zero and only climbed up. You didn't lose points for a bad lesson. You simply missed an opportunity to gain a large amount, but you still gained something for trying.
You're always leveling up.
The entire psychology of the system was relentlessly focused on progress, accumulation, and leveling up, never on punishment or regression.
That completely flips the script on competence. Mm-hmm. You're always moving forward.
And finally, the peer ranking mechanic was deeply structured around collaboration, not competition. Because you gained significant points by helping others improve through the feedback forum, it was in your best interest to be an incredibly supportive, analytical peer.
That's brilliant.
The game design successfully and beautifully mirrored Kolb's learning cycle in a way the traditional classroom never could. The mission served as the concrete experience. The automated badges and peer feedback provided immediate reflective observation.
Right.
The deep forum discussions allowed for abstract conceptualization of the pedagogy. And because the points were cumulative, the trainee was highly motivated to take those lessons directly into next week's mission, satisfying the need for active experimentation.
It really is brilliant architecture. They essentially hijacked the natural human instinct for competition and achievement and channeled it entirely into collaborative, structured, pedagogical progress.
That's a great way to put it.
So the platform is built. The rules are set. The 40 pre-service teachers have spent 4 intense weeks inside the system playing the game, earning the clarity cap and badges, writing forum posts, and leveling up their avatars.
Yep.
Now, we have to look at the cold, hard data, because theories are great, but did this elaborate, customized Moodle plugin actually produce better teachers than the traditional method?
Let's look at the numbers. To measure this objectively without any bias, the researchers utilized a highly validated, rigorous academic tool called the ELT Instructional Competence Rubric, or the ELT-ICR.
Okay.
It is crucial to understand that this isn't just a general subjective, did you like this lesson survey? It is a highly granular 20-item observational rubric scored on a rigorous 5-point scale, specifically looking at the actual observable mechanics of teaching a language classroom.
And it's as vital to highlight the methodology here. The people doing the scoring for the data were 2 highly trained independent raters who were completely blind to the experimental conditions. They were just sitting in a room watching the recorded videos of the pre-tests and the post-tests. They had absolutely no idea who was in the gamified Moodle group and who was sweating it out in the traditional control group.
That double-blind approach ensures the absolute integrity of the data. They were assessing the trainees across 3 specific critical subdomains of teaching.
What were the domains?
First, classroom management. This includes things like how smoothly a teacher transitions between activities, how they manage the pacing of the lesson, and how they physically position themselves.
Okay, that's one.
Second, instructional clarity. This measures how well they set learning objectives, how clearly they give instructions, and how well they explain complex grammar.
Got it.
And third, learner-centered techniques, which is perhaps the hardest, assessing how well they elicit language from the students, how effectively they run interactive pair work, and how they handle student errors.
Okay, this is the moment of truth. We have the blind raters, the 20-item rubric, and the 4 weeks of video. What were the actual results? Did the game work?
The results were not just positive. They showed a massive, statistically significant difference between the two groups.
How massive?
When researchers look at statistics in a study like this, they don't just look to see if one number is higher than the other. They look at something called the effect size.
Right.
The effect size determines how meaningful and powerful that difference actually is in the real world. The overall instructional competence effect size for the gamified group, measured as a partial ETA squared, was 0.36.
Okay, for those of us who haven't taken a graduate-level statistics course recently, give us some context. Is 0.36 a big deal?
It is exceptionally large. In the world of educational and psychological interventions, an effect size of 0.01 is considered small, 0.06 is medium, and anything over 0.14 is universally considered a large effect.
Mm-hmm.
So pulling a 0.36 partial ETA squared indicates a profound, highly visible, undeniably transformative impact on their actual physical, observable teaching behaviors.
That is staggering. Let's ground this by looking at the raw averages. They were scored on a 1-5 scale. Where did these 40 trainees start before the experiment began?
Before the intervention, during the baseline pretest, both groups were statistically identical, which means the random sorting worked perfectly.
Good.
The gamified experimental group averaged a 2.85 out of 5, and the traditional control group averaged a 2.90. They were all hovering right below a 3.
Okay, what does a 3 mean on this rubric?
In the context of the rubric, a score below 3 indicates a basic, somewhat unsatisfactory, highly hesitant, novice level. These are teachers who are reading from their notes, stumbling over instructions, and losing the attention of the room.
And after 4 weeks of the intervention, what happened to the scores?
After 4 weeks, the traditional control group improved slightly, moving from a 2.90 to a 3.3.
Which makes sense.
That is entirely expected. Simply practicing a skill 4 times will yield marginal improvement. But the gamified experimental group, the ones doing the missions and earning badges, jumped from a 2.85 to an astonishing 4.90 average.
A 4.90. They leaped over an entire point on a 5-point scale in just 4 sessions.
Incredible, isn't it?
That is the difference between a stumbling, anxious novice who is putting the class to sleep and a highly competent, confident practitioner who commands the room. And the breakdown of where they improved is even more fascinating. Which of the 3 subdomains saw the biggest leap?
Interestingly, classroom management saw the absolute biggest leap with an enormous effect size of 0.33. This was closely followed by lesson clarity at 0.30 and learner-centered techniques at 0.26.
So what does this all mean in a practical sense? Why did classroom management see the strongest improvement? If you think about it, managing a room full of people seems like the hardest, most nuanced thing to teach a 22-year-old novice.
It is incredibly difficult. But if you look at what classroom management actually entails in a language teaching context, the data makes perfect sense.
Okay, explain.
We aren't talking about disciplining unruly children or shouting over a noisy room. We're talking about the structural orchestration of the lesson. How smoothly you transition from a quiet reading activity to a loud speaking activity. How efficiently you manage the pacing so the lesson doesn't drag and students don't get bored. How clearly you organize people into pairs or groups of 3.
Oh, I see.
These are highly structured, deeply observable physical behaviors.
And highly structured behaviors respond perfectly to the clear, immediate feedback loop of game mechanics.
Precisely. If a trainee gets immediate mastery-oriented feedback, like a digital badge popping up, specifically rewarding them for smooth transitions, their brain immediately latches onto that mechanic.
So it's a dopamine hit.
Exactly. The gamified system takes the vague, abstract, terrifying concept of managing a classroom and breaks it down into concrete, achievable, highly rewarded micro-actions.
What about the learner-centered techniques?
Learner-centered techniques, like improvising a conversation based on a student's unexpected grammatical mistake, also improved significantly. But that is a much more fluid, complex improvisational skill, so the effect size, while still very large at 0.26, was slightly lower than the highly structural management skills.
The practical reality for the listener here is just incredible to consider. These teachers didn't just learn new theory about how a classroom should theoretically run. they objectively, measurably, visibly became better at the physical orchestration of human interaction.
They absolutely did.
It is exactly the difference between sitting in a library reading a dense book about the physics of swimming and actually getting into the pool, fixing your stroke, and swimming faster. The game didn't just make them smarter, it made them fundamentally better practitioners.
It absolutely did. But we must remember our foundational premise from the beginning of this deep dive. The observable teaching skills vastly improved, yes. But the core underlying disease of traditional micro-teaching was never a lack of theory. It was profoundly emotional. It was the paralyzing cognitive blocking anxiety.
The effective filter.
Exactly. We have to look at the psychological data to see if the gamification actually cured the root cause of the anxiety, or if it just masked it and tricked them into performing better while still terrified.
And that brings us to the internal landscape of the trainees. Did playing this game actually make them feel better, more confident, and more engaged? Or were they just as stressed, but hiding it better?
To measure the internal psychological state, the researchers utilized a tool called the SETS, the Student Engagement in Teacher Training Scale.
Okay, what is the SETS?
This is a highly nuanced 15-item psychological scale that measures three distinct dimensions of a learner's engagement: behavioral, emotional, and cognitive.
Let's define those quickly for everyone. Behavioral engagement is essentially how much physical effort you are putting in. Are you doing the reading? Are you preparing the lesson? Emotional engagement is your effective reaction. Are you paralyzed by anxiety, or are you enthusiastic and feeling capable?
Yes.
And cognitive engagement is how deeply you are thinking about the material. Are you just memorizing, or are you deeply reflecting on the principles of pedagogy?
Exactly right. And the results on the SET scale were frankly astonishing. The effect sizes for the psychological engagement were even larger than the massive effect sizes we saw for the observable teaching skills.
No way.
The total engagement, partial eta squared, was an unbelievable 0.55.
That is completely off the charts for psychological research. You rarely see interventions move the needle that drastically on human emotion.
It represents an exceptionally powerful systemic influence on their internal state. When we break down that 0.55, emotional engagement saw the highest leap of all with a 0.52 effect size.
Wow.
This definitively proves that the gamification intervention strongly, undeniably reduced their debilitating anxiety and vastly increased their enjoyment of what is normally a grueling, dreaded process.
What about behavioral and cognitive?
Behavioral engagement was right behind it at 0.51, showing a massive increase in the sheer amount of time, effort, and preparation they willingly put into their missions. And cognitive engagement was 0.49, indicating a much deeper, more complex reflection on their own teaching identity.
This raises an incredibly important question. How on earth does a simple digital badge or an anonymized Moodle point system transform an adult's deeply rooted emotional state so profoundly?
The great question.
I mean, we are not talking about kindergartners who are easily distracted by shiny gold star stickers. These are 22-year-old adults, some of them holding master's degrees, facing a high-stakes career evaluation.
True.
I have to wonder aloud on behalf of the skeptics listening if this is just a massive novelty effect. Are they actually deeply engaged in the pedagogy, or are they just temporarily distracted by the shiny new toy of a Moodle platform? Oh. Once the novelty wears off, once the game gets old, doesn't that crushing anxiety just rush right back in?
It is a highly critical, valid perspective, and one the researchers explicitly acknowledge in their discussion of limitations. Any new technology carries a novelty bump. However, the deep theoretical grounding in self-determination theory strongly suggests that the results go much deeper than mere novelty.
How so?
The badges and points themselves are not the actual intervention. They are simply the highly efficient delivery mechanism for the psychological nutrients of autonomy, competence, and relatedness.
The psychological nutrient, I love that phrasing. The points are just the vitamin capsule. The SDT fulfillment is the actual medicine.
Exactly. When an adult learner feels deeply competent because they can clearly visually see their incremental progress, and they feel a strong sense of relatedness to their peers because they are actively collaborating towards shared goals, their emotional state naturally stabilizes.
The fear goes away.
The game framing provides a powerful cognitive barrier against the perceived threat of evaluation. The evaluation is no longer interpreted as a personal attack on their identity as a teacher. It is fundamentally reinterpreted as a clear, objective mechanism to figure out how to beat the next level.
To really answer my skeptical question about whether this was just a shallow, shiny novelty, we need to transition away from the statistical spreadsheets and the massive effect sizes. We need to hear the actual human voices of the participants who lived inside this game.
Yes, the qualitative data.
Right. The researchers conducted extensive qualitative semi-structured interviews with the experimental group after the 4 weeks were over, and this qualitative data beautifully illuminates the specific human mechanisms operating behind those massive statistics.
The qualitative thematic analysis revealed three very robust recurring themes among the trainees.
What was the first theme?
The first major theme was gamification acting as an anxiety buffer. Fully 90% of the interviewed participants explicitly discussed this phenomenon.
90%, that's huge.
It is. One trainee's quote perfectly succinctly encapsulates this psychological shift. I said, the badges took the sting out of the feedback. Instead of thinking, I completely failed at classroom management today, I thought, I just haven't unlocked the manager badge yet. And it motivated me to try again next week.
Let's zero in on that specific quote because it is everything. I haven't unlocked the manager badge yet. That is a profound, fundamental shift in human psychology.
It really is.
It is the exact textbook definition of moving from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset, as defined by Carol Dweck. In a traditional, fixed mindset environment, failing a micro-teaching lesson means, I am a fundamentally bad teacher. I do not have the innate talent for this profession. I should quit. It is a catastrophic identity-level failure.
But in the gamified mindset, the failure is externalized. It is simply a temporary state of progress. The competence hasn't been achieved yet, but the path to achieve it is clear, transparent, and navigable. The point system made their progress concrete and undeniable, providing a powerful anchor of psychological safety, even when a specific 15-minute session went terribly poorly.
The second major theme from the qualitative interviews was enhanced collaborative reflection, which was cited by 85% of the participants. This speaks directly to that SDT need for relatedness, and I think it perfectly explains why the observable teaching skills improved so dramatically.
The gamified system, through the feedback forum, mandated that peers use the structured 20-item rubric to award points and provide detailed feedback to each other.
Right, they had to grade each other to get points.
Yes, a trainee explained exactly how this changed their behavior. In the past, instead of giving real feedback, I would just say good jobs or nice slides. But in the game, I'd write, you use two very clear, relatable examples for that complex grammar point, which earned you a point for instructional clarity.
I love that so much. Think about typical peer feedback in any university course or corporate workshop. It is almost always composed of useless, polite platitudes because no one wants to be mean to their friend or colleague. You did great. Your voice was loud. Your slides were pretty.
That's useless.
Totally useless. But the game mechanics force them to engage deeply with the actual pedagogical criteria. By analyzing their peers in order to award points, they subconsciously internalized the rubric themselves. They stopped being a passive, polite audience and became a rigorous, supportive community of practice.
Which leads directly and beautifully into the third qualitative theme, liberated experimentation, mentioned by 80% of the gamified group.
What does that mean exactly?
Because the crippling anxiety was buffered and because the peer feedback was highly structured and constructive, the trainees finally felt liberated to actually take risks.
There's a fantastic revealing quote for this one, too. A participant said, going for the Interaction Innovator badge pushed me to try a highly complex group debate activity that I would have never, ever attempted otherwise. The debate was incredibly messy, but the badge feedback highlighted exactly what worked and what didn't, so I ended up learning more from that messy failure than from any safe, perfectly scripted, successful lesson I'd ever done before.
That quote is just incredible. If we synthesize these three qualitative themes together, they beautifully, almost perfectly validate the theoretical frameworks we discussed earlier.
Connect those final dots for us. How does the lived experience prove the theory?
The anxiety buffer, that vital, I haven't unlocked the badge yet mentality, proves undeniably that their fundamental need for competence was being nurtured and protected.
Yes.
The enhanced collaborative reflection, where they actively decoded the rubric together, proves that their need for relatedness was deeply satisfied. They were a unified team solving a puzzle, not competitors. And that liberated experimentation, the willingness to try a messy, chaotic debate just to see if it works and chase a badge, is the ultimate, undeniable proof that they felt fully autonomous. They were making bold, independent pedagogical choices of their own free will because the environment finally supported them in doing so.
It is an airtight, incredibly compelling case. The quantitative data shows massive, undeniable improvements in both physical skill and psychological engagement, and the qualitative data explains exactly on a human level how it happened.
It's a very complete picture.
But as with all deep dives, we cannot just celebrate the victory. We have to look closely at the friction points. If this method creates highly confident, highly skilled, deeply engaged, profoundly less anxious professionals in just 4 weeks, why isn't every single university, every medical residency program, every corporate training seminar doing this tomorrow?
That is the million-dollar question.
We must examine the limitations of this specific study and the massive systemic implications of trying to scale this.
Well, the researchers themselves are very transparent and honest about the limitations of their work. First, as you astutely pointed out earlier, it is a relatively short-term intervention.
4 weeks.
Right. 4 weeks of incredible data is compelling, but the ultimate question is longitudinal. Will this deeply ingrained intrinsic motivation and high competence sustain itself when these trainees eventually graduate, leave the gamified, supportive Moodle platform behind, and step into a real, chaotic, underfunded public school classroom for a 40-year career?
Right. Does the sudden removal of the training wheels, the badges, and the points cause a massive crash down the line? What else did they flag?
There is also the potential for self-selection bias. The 40 participants were drawn from a pool of volunteers. It is a well-known phenomenon in research that individuals who actively volunteer for a teaching experiment might inherently possess a slightly higher baseline of intrinsic motivation or a greater openness to new, playful experiences than the general mandatory student population.
That is a very fair caveat. You might be measuring the enthusiasm of volunteers rather than just the power of the game. But even acknowledging those limitations, the implications for how we train adult professionals are massive.
They are deeply disruptive to the status quo. To truly implement this on a large scale, teacher training programs, and really any professional training program, would have to entirely structurally abandon the traditional teach-then-critique approach.
They'd have to start from scratch.
Basically, they would have to completely redesign their syllabi from the ground up, transforming lists of lectures into carefully scaffolded, achievable missions. Peer collaboration can no longer just be a casual turn and talk to your neighbor for 5 minutes. It must become deeply structured, criterion referenced, and integrated into the grading system.
But here's the hardest pill to swallow, and I think this is the real hidden bottleneck that stops gamification from taking over the world. It isn't the technology. The technology is easy.
Yeah, Moodle is everywhere.
Right. Moodle plugins are free or incredibly cheap. They are highly accessible to any IT department. The massive bottleneck is the faculty themselves.
The faculty development required to pull this off is the absolute largest hurdle.
Think about
teacher educators, professors, who have been doing this exact job the exact same way for 3 decades.
Sitting at the back of the room.
Yes. They have to stop being just stern evaluators sitting at the back of the room with a red pen and a clipboard. They have to undergo a massive, uncomfortable professional identity shift. They have to fundamentally become game masters and empathetic facilitators of an experience.
That is a profound tectonic cultural shift in academia. Relinquishing the power, the ego, and the authority of being the high-stakes judge to instead become a behind-the-scenes facilitator of a game requires a level of humility, adaptability, and relinquishing of control that legacy institutions are historically very, very bad at.
It changes the power dynamic of the entire classroom. The professor is no longer the sole unquestionable arbiter of success and failure. The gamified system, the clear rubric, and the peer community share that evaluative role.
Think about the massive institutional inertia at play here. If you are a curriculum designer or a department head listening to this right now, how do you justify the budget, the massive amount of faculty training time, and the political capital required to build a literal video game for your adult graduate students?
It's a tough sell.
You have to walk into a room and convince a skeptical board of directors that having 25-year-olds play a game to earn interaction innovator badges is somehow more rigorous than a traditional punishing written exam.
Even though the data proves it is.
Exactly. As we've seen clearly from the data today, it absolutely is more rigorous. It produces a massive 0.36 effect size and observable real-world competence. But changing the historical optics of what serious education looks like is a monumental uphill task.
It is a massive paradigm shift, certainly. But the empirical evidence provided by rigorous studies exactly like this one makes it increasingly difficult and, frankly, indefensible to maintain the status quo.
Agreed.
If we now have empirical proof that traditional methods actively induce cognitive blocking anxiety and severely limit practical skill development, continuing to blindly use them simply because that's how we've always done it begins to border on pedagogical malpractice.
That is a strong, bold, but entirely justified statement based on the data we've reviewed. Okay, let's pull all of these massive concepts together. We have covered a tremendous amount of intellectual and psychological ground in this deep dive.
We really have.
We started by examining the paralyzing, ubiquitous, deeply relatable anxiety of traditional micro-teaching, that universal feeling of standing before an audience and waiting for the executioner's axe to fall on your career.
And we discovered that by strategically, carefully applying gamification, not just as a superficial gimmick or a shiny distraction, but rooted deeply and intentionally in self-determination theory, we can completely rewrite the psychological contract of the adult classroom.
Yes.
By utilizing structured missions, transparent, mastery-oriented badges, and collaborative anonymized leaderboards, the researchers didn't just marginally improve the passing rate.
They completely transformed the pedagogical landscape. They drastically, measurably improved objective, observable teaching skills, particularly in highly complex dynamic areas like real-time classroom management and interactive learner-centered techniques.
Absolutely.
And simultaneously, they totally overhauled the emotional and cognitive engagement of the adults involved, massively dropping their paralyzing anxiety and spiking their effort, their reflection, and their willingness to take bold risks.
For you listening to this, whether you are in education, corporate management, or healthcare, the ultimate takeaway is a profound redefinition of what play actually means in an adult context.
Play is serious business.
Gamification is absolutely not about trivializing serious high-stakes learning. It is about deeply honoring basic hardwired human psychological needs. Whether we are 8 years old playing in a sandbox or 48 years old training for a new career, our brains desperately require autonomy, a clear path to competence, and a strong sense of relatedness to function at their highest possible capacity.
Which leaves us with a final lingering thought for you to explore as you go about your week. We now have concrete, empirical proof that reframing a high-stakes, terrifying evaluation into a structured, gamified mission makes intelligent adults perform significantly better, learn faster, and completely conquer their deepest anxieties.
It's a game changer.
So, what other broken, high-stress, archaic adult rituals should we gamify next? Think about your next high-stakes job interview. Think about a doctor's grueling, sleep-deprived medical residency. Or think about your own dread-inducing, highly subjective annual performance review. What is, instead of sitting in a cold sweat waiting for a judge's final, opaque verdict on your professional worth, you are just stepping up to the console, fully prepared, ready to analyze the data and unlock your next badge?